It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and the snow is perfect for dog mushing outside. It's we all know that those top mushers are speeding their way to Nome, and Iditarod's always an exciting time for everybody in Alaska. But I don't know if you realize that there's a lot more people out there mushing than Iditarod mushers. Those are the cream of the crop and the ones who train for these long distances. But dog mushing is also a recreational sport, and that's our topic today. It's about using dogs for transportation, using them for fun, using them to teach your kids responsibility, and just the sport of sled dog racing and just sled dog driving as part of Alaska lifestyles. And I know there are some sled dog enthusiasts out there, and probably a lot of other people have questions about the sport. So I really welcome you to get on the air with us today. The number here in Anchorage is 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And you can get us a message in writing at Outdoor Explorer on Facebook. Just go to Facebook and type in Outdoor Explorer, and you'll find our page with tons of material and people interacting on this topic. So I've got two guests today. In the studio with me is Deborah Baines, who has the Learning Farm here in Anchorage and has been a musher for three decades, involved in the local sprint racing community. Thanks for being with us, Deborah.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me.
And on the phone from the Denali area is Jamie Milliken. Jamie is a summertime interpretive ranger at Denali National Park. In the winter, he's a dog driver taking folks out for expeditions of up to 10 days or just for a quick day trip, and has his own team and uses it for recreational mushing and exploration around the middle of Alaska. Jamie, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me this afternoon.
So it's the kind of sport that obviously is a total lifestyle, right, Deborah? I mean, you have to have a certain number of dogs before you can be a dog musher, and I'm just interested in when it got started for you, when you became, now you have like a couple of dozen dogs, right?
But 29, yeah.
29 dogs. So when it got started for you, were you just a dog lover and you realized that maybe you could put these dogs in front of a sled? Or did you sort of make the decision, well, I'm going to be a musher?
Well, it was kind of a way of getting outside and doing stuff with my younger son, who was three at the time when we got started. But I've always been into animals and enjoyed animals. But you know, you can be a musher with just a couple dogs. You can do recreational mushing with two or three dogs and race also with a small team.
Uh-huh. They just have to be, I guess, the right kind of dogs, and you have to know how to train them, right?
Yeah, and you can use almost any kind of dog. I know we've had stories of people mushing shepherds and, you know, poodles and all kinds of dogs. So it's just kind of getting them used to. Quite often you can take them out and put them on with a couple experienced sled dogs so they kind of get the idea. And when you're on the trail, you get on the dog mushing trail, then it's they kind of just follow the trail.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, I guess it's the sort of thing that you learn from somebody else who's already doing it. It's sort of passed on from person to person a little bit. True?
Yeah, it's great to have people that can mentor you. And for us, it was the Alaska Sled Dog and Racing Association. They have a wonderful mentoring program for kids and,
oh, really?
And
wow.
Beginners, whether you're an adult or a child. And they have a junior program that in the fall starts meeting every Friday at the clubhouse on the Tozier track. And they have guest speakers on all kinds of topics on everything from veterinary care to sled handling and harnessing, all kinds of topics to help the kids.
Mm-hmm. So you don't have to dive all the way in. You can sort of get into that community and start to learn about it.
And there are people that have lent dogs to kids so they can get out and try it and race. And mm-hmm. What we've had is... for our B team that our kennel partner races, my son has taught dog mushing to kids, and we've had once they have taken his instruction, we will rent them for races.
Oh, I see. So you don't have to have your own dogs.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a link to that organization you just mentioned, Anchorage Sled Dog and Racing Association, on our web page, as well as links to Deborah's business, the Learning Farm, and a lot of other links that might be of interest to listeners. You find that at alaskapublic.org and just look for today's show and it's all there. Jamie, you are taking folks out on mushing treks and also just day mushing who have never done it before. And maybe they're just curious or they just want to give it a try. And I'm just interested, and you're up there at the Earth Song Lodge outside of Healy where you have a big mushing program. What's the reaction of the typical newbie the first time they're behind a dog team?
It's one of kind of shock and surprise, I think. I think people just don't realize how strong and how fast and how dedicated I think the dogs are to their jobs. I think they might get out there and just kind of trot along and kind of goof off, but then I think they're really kind of humbled by how seriously the dogs take their job and how quickly and how fast the dogs can move and how much power is behind the sled. I think the hardest thing for new folks to do is just even stop the sled once it gets moving, because the dogs are so focused and going, and so they just don't realize it's going to take most of their strength to even stop the sled. And I think most new people think it's just they're going for an amusement park ride. They're just going to stand there. They don't have to do a whole lot of work. And we'll take people out, say, for a day where they mush the dogs 4, 5, 6 hours, and they can't believe how physically exhausted they are at the end of that when they realize how much work, physical work, there actually is just being behind the sled and running the sled. So
because you're steering the sled in terms of keeping it from tipping over by leaning from side to side.
You're constantly pulling the sled back and forth, right or left, to keep it from tipping over. If you're going up hills, you might be running behind the sled, pushing along with a foot the side, and then there's also the physical action of braking. So you're just never just standing there. Your body is always moving one way or the other. Even if you're just going on a straight stretch, you're absorbing the bumps in your trail with your knees and things like that. So
yeah, well, what you say about being surprised by the power of the dogs and the intelligence of the dogs is certainly what I experienced the first time and only time I drove a sled, which was that, you go into it with the thought, well, how am I going to get these dogs to run, right?
Yeah.
And then next thing you know, you're just whizzing down the trail at a speed that you could not possibly have anticipated. And the dogs are doing all the thinking. You know, you might have thought you'd be in control, but really they know what the heck they're doing, and they're just pulling you along at an extraordinary speed and with amazing level of intelligence. And any control you have is verbal, right? It's what you're yelling at them.
It is correct. I mean, basically all the control is either, mostly verbal. And that's how we do all, that's how we turn, that's how we stop, that's how we pick up the pace or slow down the pace. And with stopping, it's conjunction with hitting the brake on the sled. But it's all intelligence of the dogs. If I need to turn right, they're the ones that are turning right. It's not me. I can't go up there and make them. I use the commands, but they are the ones that are doing that. And they're the ones pretty much running the show. I'm kind of the backseat driver, so to say. But I've spent hours and hours training them to be able to run that show up there. So.
Right. Well, I mean, I would think letting somebody drive my dog team who's never driven a dog team would be a little scary. I mean, I don't necessarily want anybody driving my car, and that's probably a lot easier than driving a dog team. How does that, when you've got somebody brand new, you must give them some training and stuff to get them started.
Oh, yeah. When they show up the first day of the trip, we don't even go out overnight the first day. We do what's called a training day the first day. So they'll show up at the lodge or here at my house, at my kennel. And basically, when they get out of the car and step up, I've got the dog sled set out. I've got the gang line and all the lines laid out. And essentially, I start from the beginning where the lead dog gets hooked up, and I talk about every part of that sled and line all the way to the back of the sled where they actually will be standing and driving the sled. And I go through all the things, the brakes, where you hold on to, where you stand, all those kind of things. One of the big questions I ask people is if they've ever skied before or done any sport that involves balance, surf, ski, snowboard, because people that have done those sports before, they usually have a head start on other people that haven't done a balanced involved sport before, because they can balance the sled when it tips off the side of the trail or you're going over uneven terrain. And so I kind of explained balancing, steering the sled a little bit. I mean, the dogs will make the turns, but of course you can lean one way on the sled, it'll kind of track one way. You lean the other way, it tracks the other way. And so I go through, I spend about an hour doing that with everybody. And then we actually go into the dog yard. Then I spend another bit of time showing them how to harness dogs, how to move dogs around. That's probably the big thing is if they have to move the dog from the dog yard to the sled, how are they going to do it without that dog just pulling them all over the place?
Mm-hmm.
And then, but it is nervous when it's my dogs and somebody new behind me. I think that's the most nervous thing for me is the fact that they are my dogs, and I don't want to get to see them get hurt. I don't want to see the people get hurt either, but I definitely don't want to see my dogs get hurt by something. So that's why I'm very thorough with training the folks beforehand, so I feel comfortable that they're going to be good with the dogs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Wow, interesting. That's Jamie Milliken talking to us. He's a musher up in the Denali area. He works with Earthsong Lodge, where there's a mushing program where folks can go out. Mostly people have never done it before. It's in Healy on the Stampede Road. There's a link to that on our website at alaskapublic.org. And in the studio with me is Deborah Baines, who has a learning farm here in Anchorage, teaches kids to mush and teaches them about farming and farm animals in a program that I've heard good things about. That's how I heard about Deborah, was talking to another parent. If you have any questions about mushing, I have a ton of questions. You know, I've lived in Anchorage all my life and have seen dog mushing, and these questions sort of pile up, you know, but you don't necessarily get a chance to ask them. Well, this is your chance. It's 550-8433 to get on the air with us, 550-8433, outside Anchorage, 888-353-5752. And there's a discussion on Facebook at Outdoor Explorer. Just put Outdoor Explorer into Facebook and you'll find us. Deborah, we were talking about new people learning to mush. You're working mostly with kids, and I would guess that there's a whole additional set of concerns with kids. And how do you see mushing benefiting kids, and then what sort of challenges do you have in teaching kids to mush?
Oh, the benefits are great. Being outdoors, being active, learning to handle the animals. It's a huge confidence builder for them to be out on the trail and learn how to handle situations that come up because they are on their own. Mm-hmm. Once they're past the one dog, and a lot of people don't realize that a four-year-old is old enough to race here in Anchorage.
Wow.
At 4 to 7, they can race one dog on a quarter-mile trail, and that's the most entertaining one to watch, of course.
I bet it is.
And then from there, they can start. So it's regulated by age. So at 8, they can start racing two dogs on the two-mile. And when they're out there, they have to know how to respond to different situations, whether it's a moose on the trail or if their dogs get tangled, and they have to learn to unharness them and re-harness them and handle whatever situation. They have to be able to hook down the sled and go manage the dogs on their own. So, you know, at 8 years old, that's pretty responsible.
Yeah, really.
During races, we do have trail guards out there all over to help kids in any situation, but they do need to learn how to, that's part of the sport. They mm-hmm. need to know how to manage that. So
how do you introduce them to that kind of responsibility?
What we do at the house is we pull a small sled behind a four-wheeler, so they learn. Dalton will actually have them tip over and learn how to get back uprighted, how to set the hook, and manage the difference. And of course, they do a lot of harnessing and re-harnessing, so they're proficient at that.
Mm-hmm. And this is almost like a camp experience for them, where it's an outdoor learning experience for them, where they're learning to be mushers and how to handle dogs at your place.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's a separate class Dalton mm-hmm. does with... And it's more of a one-on-one. He'll have two or three kids at max at a time for those classes.
So what kind of trouble can kids get in? I mean, the team takes off and it's out of control. I mean, I can just imagine as a parent all kinds of things happening.
Oh, yeah. They can fall over and get drug along the trail. Mm-hmm. And they have to, like I said, a lot of it's just tangled with another team. They do send them out every 2 minutes, so they're not as likely to. There is passing that goes on in the juniors, but
mm-hmm. there's people around. Yeah. So where do you do your training here in Anchorage? You out on the Campbell Tract, or?
Yeah, for our training, we go out on the Tozier Track on Tudor Road.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like there's that track, the Tozier Tract is, that's kind of self-contained, but then there's the trails that go off. What is the Tozier Track exactly?
Yeah, the Tozier Track is, they own that 10 acres there at the clubhouse and mm-hmm. beyond that area. And it does hook up with the Bicentennial Park.
Right.
But they've actually, the Dog Musher Club has a designated dog mushing trail that we maintain through the year. Mm-hmm. And we try to post it as well as possible. And we have actually given up all our rights to other multi-use trail to have one designated trail, which goes over a lot of swampland, so it's really not a, mm-hmm. It's not a usable trail through the summer. But we do pay to maintain that, and it's safer for, you know, we try to have it exclusive dog mushing, because if people are walking their dogs, you can't hear us coming, and some of these teams can be clipping along pretty good, and to have a skier or somebody walking their dog collide with a dog team is not good for either one of them.
Well, I've noticed that. Actually, it was on the tour of Anchorage last Sunday, crossing the dog mushing trail. It's really well signed. A lot of warning signs to, you know, be safe. And I think there's some overpasses and stuff, so mm-hmm. you can avoid some conflicts. Does it work out pretty well, or do you get walkers and?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
All the time, yeah, and some of them, we've tried to post it well, but there are, like, I think we have counted close to 100, you know, where intersections with ski trails, walking trails, so that's a lot of signs to put out, and we have tried to mark the dog trail, so, but, you know, some people disregard.
Yeah, well, we talked about that when we did a cross-country skiing show a couple of weeks ago, is that there's a bit of trail envy in Anchorage, where folks think, well, why do you have your special trail? We should get to use it. But then you kind of need a special trail, because, as you say, the dog teams are quiet and fast, and you can get into quite a tangle.
Oh, yeah. And like I said, it's dangerous for both the dog team and, you know, and other dogs or skiers to get run over by a mm-hmm. dog team.
Yeah. So we're talking about dog mushing today on Outdoor Explorer. And I guess this, going back to you, Jamie Milliken, up there in Healy, hearing some of Deborah's urban dog mushing issues, your issues must be pretty different, but you have hazards you have to deal with it with your guests as well, moose, and I don't know, what else, what other kind of hazards do you have to think about?
Yeah, we definitely don't have the urban, our trails are, I guess you could say, they're multi-use, because it's just kind of a free-for-all out here of what goes on. So we do have, but we don't have dog walkers generally. We'll have skiers, ski jors occasionally. They stay pretty close to right at the beginning of the trails here. The main things we do get on our trails farther out are snow machiners, and then animals, of course, as well. Snow machiners, for the most part, during most of the winter, we don't see too many out here. Generally about this time of year, though, March, when it's getting warmer, the days are longer, the snow's good, then we start getting the snowmobilers out here. The thing that's nice about snow machines is when I'm on my dog team, I can hear them coming from a long distance away. So if I'm in a spot where I don't have good visibility, I can usually get to somewhere where I can see them coming, and they can come around a corner and see me stopped before they're going to come headlong into me. Probably the biggest things we have out here are terrain and wild animals. I mean, we do put the trails in. We use a lot of, we cross a lot of rivers out here. We go through rivers, so we deal with ice, overflow, things of that nature. And then wild animals. We have moose. They like to use our trails just as much as we do. So usually a few times a winter I have a showdown where a moose, and usually they'll eventually get out of my way. And then, but I've had dog teams chase caribou. I've had where I've gone for a wild ride, running around in the tundra chasing a group of caribou.
And they're focused on the caribou, so you've lost control on some of them.
Definitely not. Well, yeah. Part of the thing is, a good leader is they'll at least stay on the trail. It's just, if they see those caribou, now we're going four times faster than we normally would, and it's hard to stop them, so it's kind of a wild, bouncy ride generally. And then usually, of course, we can't catch the caribou. They can always get away from us. And then, but then
dogs think they can catch anything. Yeah.
Yep. I've seen wolves out there. Last year, where we were camped one day, we had a wolf walk right into the middle of where all the dogs were staked out camping, and dogs all barked. Wolf kind of stood there for a few minutes, and then he just eventually wandered away. So.
That sounds scary.
Yeah. But I think I'd have been more scared if there were a whole group of wolves, but he just seemed to be by himself. So,
during the dark part of the winter, are you taking guests out and mushing in the dark?
We never run guests in the dark. That's kind of one of our hard, fast rules, that we never have guests run in the dark. Now, I do it all the time, but it's just not safe for them, especially it's harder to read trail conditions. You're not going to see that. You might not see that tree limb hanging across the trail. So we try really hard never to have guests in the dark. So that kind of limits our trips a little bit. In the early part of the winter, we really have to maximize our small amount of daylight we have. So we generally don't run the big multi-day trips until around this time of year, where we've actually got plenty of daylight and time to really get from place to place.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of person should go on a multi-day dog mushing trip? I mean, you said it's great if the person has some sense of balance or has done something involving balance in the past. And also, it's fairly physically taxing, so I don't think you want a total couch potato. But do you find that people, a broad range of, you know, types of people enjoy it?
Oh, yeah. We have folks from all over the world do this, all ranges of kind of physical activity. Now, when you do sign up a trip, John has them fill out a big form, kind of get an idea, of course, size, weight, physical activity. Do they feel like they're in good shape? What kind of exercise they do? Do they play sports? Things like that. So we have a general idea of the type of person they are and what they can be able to handle. And I think John does most of the booking, so I think he's pretty good at steering people to the correct type of offering that we have based on their physical needs and abilities.
Mm-hmm. And I meant to ask this earlier, but when we were talking about trails, do you, I know motorized activity has to stay out of the national park. Are you able to mush into the park, and do you sort of look at the beautiful park vistas on your dog sleds?
We do mush into the park. John is the licensed concessionaire to be able to operate the trips inside of the park. So he's the only business that can do that. So we do go into the park.
Is that a major attraction for you guys?
I think it is. I think that's probably the big draw of this our business here. I mean, there are dog mushing guiding businesses all over the state, but I think that's one of the reasons why we stay busy is because people, especially from out of state, other countries, Denali is a big Alaskan draw. So, and then the dog sledding, you type both of those together in the computer and up pops us. And so I think it is a big draw that they can mush here right along the boundary of the park and actually go into the park.
Yeah. Yeah. It does sound great. And when we're talking about John Nirenberg, who's the owner of the Earth Song Lodge. And there's a link to that on our website, alaskapublic.org. Jamie Milliken, who's with us from Denali. Deborah, here in Anchorage, you've kind of had a challenging year for mushing, some cancellations, and it seems like last year was good, but we've had a lot of bad snow years for mushing in the last 10 years or so.
Yeah, it's our kennel partner is actually the groomer for the dog trail, and it has been a real challenge to maintain a trail suitable for mm-hmm. racing.
Do you have a way to train the dogs and keep mushing when there's not enough snow, or is it sort of like they're idle when you can't mush?
Oh, no, we do four-wheeler training, but that's also a challenge. Like I said, in Anchorage, you're not allowed to do any motorized training on our trails. So, and also our trails aren't, like I said, they're really not usable unless the ground's frozen and you have a little snowpack. But we'll go to Chugiak Trail, and you can use four-wheel training in Chugiak.
Sort of that Beach Lake area trail?
Mm-hmm, the Beach Lake trail is correct.
And that's a dedicated mushing trail, yes, or multi-use?
It's pretty much dedicated, I believe. Mm-hmm.
To find that, you kind of go beyond Chugiak High School and keep going down that road?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, you go by maybe quarter of a mile and take a left onto the Beach mm-hmm. Lake Road.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're talking about dog mushing today on Outdoor Explorer, and we're going to do that a little bit more in just a little while. I'll be giving out the phone numbers and reintroducing our guests. But right now it's time for the Outdoor Explorer calendar. Tomorrow night, Friday, March 8th, Visit Denali National Park in Winter will be presented from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Anchorage REI. A representative from Denali Park will offer trip planning advice and resources, trail condition observations, and talk about the work of the National Park Service dog teams. For more info, contact REI in Anchorage. On March 15th, a cardboard sled derby will be held at Kincaid Park in Anchorage. All ages are welcome to race down the sledding hill on your own sled made from cardboard, duct tape, and white glue. For more info, contact the Kincaid Outdoor Center. That one sounds like a lot of fun. And on March 29th through April 7th, Flow Tailgate Alaska is coming up in Valdez. For 2 weeks, a humble parking lot is transformed into the epicenter of the snowboarding and skiing universe. Yurts are set up, tents pitched, and barbecues and helicopters fired up. There'll be snow science and survival education, sled riding, and sled maintenance clinics. So check that out. That sounds something you can plan for at the end of the month. Anyway, for these events and others, we have links and more information at alaskapublic.org. Just click on today's show and you'll see the calendar and all those links. Finally, coming up this weekend, the Manitoba Hut Grand Opening is Saturday, March 9th. To tell us more about the celebration of the new hut and the open house this Saturday, we have on the phone John Wolf, Executive Director of the Alaska Mountain Wilderness Huts Association. John, thanks for being with us.
Great. Yeah, thanks.
So for those of us who don't know about your activities, tell us what a wilderness hut is.
All right. Well, Alaska Huts is a nonprofit organization, and we've been working for several years to find the right spot for ultimately for a hut-to-hut system, like you might find in Scandinavia or the Alps or New Zealand. Manitoba Cabin is our first hut, and it's a standalone cabin, but it's on the model of those kind of huts. And so it's a multi-party hut. It's big enough for an education group, and it'll hold more than one party at a time. We have refurbished an old mining cabin that used to be a ski club cabin as well, and we've added two 16-foot yurts as bedrooms, and got it all fixed up and ready for spring ski season.
All right, now tell us, where is the hut exactly? How do you get to it?
Manitoba Cabin is located on the Seward Highway, or near the Seward Highway. It's milepost 48. There's a large pullout right at milepost 48, and that's near Lower Summit Lake, near the high point of the Seward Highway as it passes through the Kenai Mountains.
And it's like a mile off the road or something?
Yeah,
along.
The cabin itself is it's something like three-quarters of a mile off the road, about 15 minutes on skis.
Now, the idea is that you're outdoors and you can use the hut, and do you pay a fee or reserve it, or how is that going to work to when the hut is in operation? How do people get access to it?
Yeah, we had sort of a soft opening starting earlier this winter at the holidays, and so people have been using it, and we've been ironing out the bugs and making sure we know how it works. And yes, it's by reservation. Ultimately, we'll have an online reservation system, but right now it's just a manual system where a board member is taking reservations by phone, and we're ultimately planning to have it available at times where you can just rent a single bunk if you want. Right now, for simplicity, we're doing it by the yurt. There's these two yurts. We're asking people to form a group and take the whole yurt at once. And with that, you get the use of the cabin, which is the living space, mm-hmm. shared living space, full kitchen, and such as that.
I see. And there's a charge, obviously, for doing that?
Yeah, the rate for a yurt is $150 per night, this opening season rate. Member rates are $125 a night, which if you fill it up is a pretty good deal at
Yeah.
Just over $18 a person.
So your grand opening is on Saturday, and what time is it, and what do people need to know about coming?
Yeah, it's a kind of an informal open house all day Saturday. The idea is that as people are skiing up to Manitoba Mountain or looking for a place for a ski tour or snowshoe tour, that they could just stop in and check it out. But we will have several things going. We've called it 10 a.m. to dusk. It's fairly flexible timing. People can come and go as they desire. But we are going to have people gather if people want to ski up on Manitoba Mountain. We'll have a first trip up the mountain for telemarking and that kind of skiing at 11 a.m. and another ski tour opportunity at 1 p.m. Those are the main scheduled things. When those tours end around 4, we'll have a food demonstration and tasting by Adventure Appetites. They'll be down there using the kitchen facilities and showing off their products and offering tastes.
Great. Well, thanks.
We'll have.
Did I cut you off there?
Sound. We'll have High Lonesome Sound playing music. Sorry, what was that?
No, I cut you off there. Okay, and music too. It sounds like a great event and pretty much going on all day. And folks want to get more information, you'll find a link on our website. I keep saying that, but it's tons of information there. AlaskaPublic.org, there's a link right to John's event. So thanks for being with us, John, Executive Director of the, get the name right, Alaska Mountain and Wilderness Huts Association. Thanks for being with us.
All right, thank you.
All right, we will be back in just a moment longer with more of Outdoor Explorer. Stay with us.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer from KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1. If you're listening in the evening, it is a recorded rebroadcast and will not be taking phone calls. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime, download podcasts, and see what's coming up on future programs at alaskapublic.org.
And some of those programs that are going to be coming up on Outdoor Explorer over the next few weeks. Next week, we'll be talking about ice climbing. Annie Fite is going to be the host. And then the week after that, we'll be talking about teaching kids how to downhill ski and do other outdoor activities. We've got all four of the next shows that are coming up on our website. And welcome listeners to take a look at those and give us any input. You know, maybe you have questions on those topics or ideas for guests. It'd be really helpful to hear from folks about what they'd like to hear on the show and what they'd like to have us plan for future shows, anything about the outdoors. And something else that I wanted to highlight is we've been trying to bring together videos for each show, sort of ride-along videos that show you what the topic is we're talking about. And there's a great video on the site by Dr. Christine Roloffs, who is a pediatric dentist and is running the Iditarod. And the video is from her point of view as she's running her dogs through the woods, I guess around Anchorage. So to find that again, you're going to go to alaskapublic.org and click on today's show. And Deborah Baines, my guest in the studio, I guess knows Dr. Roloffs and has some experience with her mushing.
Oh, yes. Christine's just been wonderful. She's been active with the Anchorage Dog Mushing Club. She's been a big supporter of the juniors. She's lent dogs to kids so that they could race. She's been a financial supporter of the kids club. So she's been just a great mentor to many people.
Yeah, and this is a really tight community with people helping each other out. That seems obvious.
Yes, it is.
So one of the things about her video is that listeners might not be aware of is the silence of this sport, that you would think the dogs are barking, but once they're running, they're very quiet, aren't they?
Yes, it's really quiet. That's definitely something that, well, like the old sleighs years ago, that's why they had the jingle bells on them so that they could, they were also quiet. So you can hear snow.
So you can hear
them. We don't have any jingle bells, so we can come up on you pretty fast.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and just because the dogs are breathing hard, they're not going to be barking when they're running. Yeah. Get on the air with us if you have any questions. The number here at the show is 550-8433, outside Anchorage, 888-353-5752, and on Facebook, Outdoor Explorer, if you have comments or questions that you want to send that way. And we're talking about mushing with Deborah Baines from the Learning Farm here in Anchorage, and Jamie Milliken, who is a guide in the Denali area and a summertime interpretive ranger at Denali National Park, about mushing as a recreational activity, not necessarily the professional racers who get all the media, but all the other folks are doing it. So, Jamie, I wanted to talk to you about the training of dogs. Obviously, you're working with people who don't have much experience or any experience, and you're putting them in charge of these teams and sending them off across the wilderness. How do you train dogs to be able to be sled dogs, and you know, what's the trick? I can't get my kid's dog to even come inside.
Well, luckily, most of my dogs and the dogs I have all Alaskan Huskies, but luckily from birth, I think it's in tune in their head that they want to run and pull, and so basically, they know they want to run and pull. It's deep down inside them. It's just we have to train them how to kind of focus that and do it correctly where they're not going to hurt themselves or hurt other dogs. And basically the training with our guys starts as puppies right out the get-go. When puppies are old enough to leave their mother at 8 weeks old, we're starting training right then. And training starts small then. It's just socializing the dogs. I have to have dogs that see a variety of different folks come through here. And so, of course, they have to be friendly with people. So we take a puppy that we have, we socialize it, we get it around lots of friends, take it out to places so it gets used to being out there. And then, of course, we take that dog and exercise it. They kind of get free rein as pups. They can run around the dog yard. They learn which of the adult dogs are going to be friendly and will play with them, which of the adult dogs really may not want anything to do with the puppies. And then usually, if we have the puppies in the summer, by the time fall training starts, which I start training my adult dogs usually around beginning to mid-October, that's usually when I finish my summer job, and we'll start using the four-wheeler up until we get enough snow. Usually here, we're lucky enough by mid to late October, we've got enough snow on the ground, I can at least go out and bounce along on the sled over the trails, and when those puppies are big enough, they just run along loose behind the adult dogs. They get to go out, see what's like on the trail, and they'll do that for a few months. And then my puppy, I have one puppy this year that was born in the summer, and I guess about 2 months ago, she actually started running loose with her harness on. And then what I do is I leave an empty spot in the team where my dogs are running in pairs. I'll leave one spot open, so there's only one dog in a certain spot on the team. And then I know the puppies are kind of ready when they find their way into that empty spot and start running along with the team in that spot, not hooked in. And then I kind of know they're ready to start pulling. And so when they're in that spot, I'll stop the team. I'll clip them into the lines, and away we go. And I might let the puppy run for a mile or so, and then I'll clip it back out again. I want it to be fun. And so if she starts to look like it's not fun or she's not having a good time, off the line she goes again, and she can run around and play. And then we just slowly build up the amount of time they're in the lines until we're building up. And over this first winter, my puppies from last summer, that's what they're doing. And now they've built up where they'll run 20 miles or so with the big dogs now. So. Hmm.
And you mentioned you use Huskies.
Yes.
And why do you choose that breed?
Essentially, I feel like they're the best dog. The Alaskan Husky is essentially a dog that's been bred here in Alaska. It's kind of a generic term for a dog that can run and pull a sled. And it's a dog that kind of, the lines of these dogs go back, I think, to the gold rush era of dogs that were bred specifically to run and to pull something along. And so I feel they're the best. They're the best suited for the conditions they have here. I got my guys have big, thick, two-layer fur coats. They have good feet. I have a dog that's a little bigger than what most people are familiar with, the typical Iditarod dog. My dogs are generally about twice as big as an Iditarod dog. Basically, I'm not breeding dogs to go fast. I'm breeding dogs to cover a large distance and pull quite a bit of weight. If we do a camping trip or something, they've got to be able to pull all the gear along that we're going to need throughout the trip.
Mm-hmm. Whereas the racing dogs are might be lighter, have a thinner coat, have be more attuned to just speed.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. My dogs are not fast at all. My average speed when I'm on a trip with a pretty heavily loaded sled, if I'm moving 6-7 miles an hour, I feel like I'm making pretty good time.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard many times that sled dogs can't be pets. Pets have to, and sled dogs have to be separate. Is that true?
That is not true. I have a small enough kennel. My wife and I, we have 18 dogs, and most of them do. They live outside. They are sled dogs, but we do have a couple older ones, and then we have a young pup as well that we've been raising as a pet, and she is a perfect pet dog. She's laying on the floor at my feet right now in front of me, and so I think if you train them both ways, they know they can be a pet dog, and I definitely think some huskies, they might not be as good if they're more high-strung, but she's a pretty mellow dog, and so she's working out to be a pretty good both pet and sled dog. So,
Deborah was nodding about sled dogs can be pets, and she's got sort of another end of the sport with sort of more of an urban kennel and more of a sprint dogs, but you feel they can be pets.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, we have quite a few of them that we've had. We'll actually rotate them in the house and let them hang out in the house with us. We're really blessed to have Heather Hardy had run Rondi several times, and when she got married and got out of mushing, she gave my son her two Rondi leaders and a swing dog, which they're house trained and they're good with the cats and very very suitable for being inside. But she was every night of the Rondi, she would actually bring her whole Rondi team in the house with her at
wow.
night. But, yeah, that was quite phenomenal.
Yeah. So I'm getting the sense that you have a tremendous number of animals. I mean, how many animals do you have around your place?
I don't really want to count. We have 11 horses. We have two baby calves that we just got last week. That we were bottle feeding, which is a big highlight for the kids to be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
We have some few chickens and a couple ducks. We have miniature goats, three sheep, two older ones, and a lamb. We've got two bigger potbelly and another potbelly pig in the front yard that the kids all. Our front yard has two old retired sled dogs that will be 16 this summer. That was my son's two-dog team when he was 7-8 years old. And I have in the front yard, I have two bunnies, two retired sled dogs, a potbelly pig, a lamb, and now two calves. So the kids go out there and they get to handle all of them, and we uh-huh. send them out with grain. They get to hand feed all the animals. And so it's a nice retirement for the dogs, as we have a shed for the pig to go into. It has heat lamps. So if whatever the weather is, they can go hang out in the shed with the heat lamps or in their insulated dog houses, either one.
Uh-huh. And the kids are coming for your program and just be interacting with the animals and being around them. Do all these animals get along?
It is pretty interesting. We didn't intend to have the bunnies loose with the dogs, but this fall I didn't have rabbit hutches built, so they were in kennels in the heated area, and the kids didn't close the kennel door, and next thing I know, they're hopping around, and lo and behold, the dogs were fine with them, and didn't. So it worked out
wow.
pretty well. I think maybe 5 years ago, it wouldn't have ended so well, but
you could have those kids could have gotten an education that you weren't planning on.
Yeah, prey predator. Yeah. We avoid that.
Yeah, really. So, and what is the breed of dog that you use in contrast to what Jamie was talking about with the big huskies?
Yes, ours are primarily husky mixed with English Pointer and German Shorthair is the two main ones that we're bred in with Sprint, maybe a little Greyhound, but mostly those two they call European hounds. And just, you know, we've done this for quite a few years now, but last year, Ken Cheezik's wife, Lori, Ken won Rondi last year, and she was explaining to me that the a lot of people do use the hounds as straight hounds. They'll use straight pointers and straight for Sprint, Skeeger. They're pretty popular. They're for the wind and strength. They add a lot of muscle and speed, a lot more speed than the Huskies. But she was explaining to me that for the efficient stride, the hound has a wider stride in the back. The husky has a more efficient narrow stride, and they prefer to not have more than half hound to get a more efficient gait.
So it's a matter of breeding the qualities you want. You're not so much worried about getting a purebred. You're worried about you're thinking about getting the dog that's going to be able to go fast pulling. Compared to Jamie, he's talking about pulling a heavy sled. Your sled is probably empty, right?
Yes, there are sleds are definitely. We've started with the old wood ones. We do have some, but for racing, my son uses the European sleds, which are lightweight. They have almost a ski, like a regular narrow ski that has camber, and it's they have a bag on them, but the bag are. Sled bag is designed just to hold a dog or two, hopefully not more than that. If you have to load a dog that's been injured or for whatever reason can't run with the team. So during a race, you have to come back with all the dogs you started with. So you need to.
Right. So it's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about dog mushing today. If you have questions, the number is 550-8433. And on Facebook, just go to Outdoor Explorer. Deborah, this sounds like this sport, I realize you could get into it on a small level, but I mean, it's expensive to feed that many dogs. And I would think it would be a tremendous amount of effort just because dog care is every day. You can't exactly go on vacation and put them in a...
Exactly. Oh, yeah. I've had horses since I was 12, and it's way more labor-intensive to have a dog team, especially with this many. But yeah, every day, you know, Dalton goes out at around 10 in the morning and he waters them all, and then they get go out and clean every day, and then they're fed in the afternoon, and then they get another watering after that.
So and how much food do they go through, 29 dogs?
Oh boy, you'd have to ask Dalton that, but I know we get dog food by the pallet.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is there a dog mushing supply store here in Anchorage where you buy the materials and stuff you need?
Not really. There used to be a Ray's Harness Shop that's no longer in business, but there's a number of dog food companies that specifically design a dog food for the racing dogs. So for the physical and stamina they need.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a high protein, high fat.
I see. Jamie, same question for you. I mean, how much work is it taking care of your dogs? I mean, it seems like it would be pretty all-consuming.
It's pretty all-consuming. It's mostly my life. Luckily, I have a wife who has, I guess, what you'd call a real job, and she goes to work every day, and I stay here. But, I get up in the morning. If I'm going to do a run, I get up several hours before the run. I feed and water the dogs in the morning. I go out and do my run. Of course, you have to clean up the yard every day. They get fed and watered again in the evening as well. And so it is. You're pretty much here with the dogs. Luckily, I live in a community of several dog mushers, and we're all pretty good about letting each other get away occasionally. And so if my wife and I want to go on vacation, get away for a few days, luckily I have several other mushers in the area that are more than happy to come over and feed our dogs and take care of them. Well, of course, in return for when they want to get away, we'll do the same for them.
And I guess for both of you, I mean, you don't have to have 20 or 30 dogs or something like that. You can do the sport with just a few dogs. But
oh, yeah. And yeah. I mean, we did it for several years with, I mean, we started where we just had a Skeejor dog. And then it was one of those things, well, I can get a small sled if we get a couple more dogs. And it just kind of slowly built like that. And to the end now is basically my wife and I have two 8 and 9 dog teams that allows us to be able to carry enough gear to do several day camping trips if my wife and I want to go out and explore.
I see, yeah. And we have a caller, Shirley from Anchorage. Shirley?
Hey, Charles. I just wanted to let people know that you can get involved doing this without having a lot of expense and a lot of dogs by volunteering to help some of our urban mushers. You can, I know, contact them because I have through the clubs at Beach Lake or Tozier Track. And I've pooled dogs with friends, and a lot of the mushers, after they're comfortable with you and their dogs, they'll give you their old and slows to run. And it's an experience that, you know, it's manageable for a lot of people. And, you know, we've skied your also and had, well, my son was in kindergarten, first grade. I used to hook the family pet up, the husky up to the little kid sled, just a plastic sled, and tail rope it. And she used to pull them home from school, and it was quite a hit around the school. All the kids whose parents made them ride in the car were so envious of the fun that we had. So there's a lot of ways to go about getting into it without having to get the full-blown kennel and have to support a bunch of dogs. So,
yeah, I would think ski-touring would be a good introduction to this because you, you don't need a sled, and if you already know how to ski, you just essentially need a harness and some ropes, right?
Right, and there's a ski-door club in town that will help you get started, and they actually give clinics that teach people how to, you know, help train their dogs. And, yeah, my son really takes off with ours now. We can't keep up with him, but, you know, he's almost 12, and our dog, we have a hound, so she's a fast one. But it's a great deal of fun for the whole family.
Oh, sounds like fun.
Yeah, we've even pulled off birthday parties when our son was really small in our acre-fenced lot, with old and slow sled dogs and little kids and a bunch of adults giving them, you know, a really good time outdoors.
So you're borrowing these dogs essentially and then giving them back at the end of the day, or you're adopting them?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. That's a good deal.
Oh, yeah. And then we also, we pool dogs. We, you know, we have friends that we get together with several dogs, and that way we only have to have one or two each, and you put them together and you have a team.
Yeah, sometimes I wish I could have just borrowed my kid's dog instead of having to keep it all the time. All right, thanks for calling, Shirley.
All right, bye-bye.
So back to this topic of getting started, is there a place where you can get a sled? Those sleds are expensive, right? Can you borrow one? Or, I mean, that's sort of the starting investment is buying a sled. Deborah?
Well, I think that's probably a dog is... Good
well,
to have
well I'm assuming you have a dog. Like you've got the family husky or something, and you want to like have it pull your kid around the backyard, just sort of getting started.
Yeah, there's I know you can get a hold of the dog clubs, and a lot of times people are selling their used sleds. Would be a good way to go. That way you're not investing in a brand new sled.
Mm-hmm.
But if you contact both the Chugiak or the Anchorage, a lot of times you can. People always have older sleds for sale.
And like the caller said, the mushers are looking for volunteers. They would probably welcome that kind of contact in terms of getting somebody to help them out. And
oh yeah, there's always a need for volunteers and coming out to help with chores and help handle. It's always can use more help.
A lot of work involved to this. Yeah.
Yes.
And you mentioned the Sled Dog Associations here in Anchorage and Chugiak. The links are on our website at alaskapublic.org. There's money involved in these races. Is it enough money to cover the cost of the sport for most of the competitors?
No. You'd need to look at, sponsors or other means of supporting. It's definitely couldn't rely on the purses from races.
Yeah, so you need to have some. You need to have some resources to do this. That would be a dream to think you'd do it through racing, even for the best. I would imagine.
Oh yeah.
All right, Heidi has a question for us about getting started. Heidi.
Hi, Charles. It's not really a question. I just wanted to comment that I used to mush dogs up in the same area as Earthsong Lodge, and when I came to town, I thought my mushing days were over. And then I realized that I could go out with just one dog, and we have wonderful multi-use trails in Bicentennial, Far North Park. And but I want to put in a word for bike-during instead of ski-during. People think that the only thing they can do with one dog is get on their skis, I personally can't ski. I think it's insane. It's very dangerous. But I can have my dog pull me on my bike, my fat tire bike, and we have a great time. So that's another way to get into the sport on a small scale.
Uh-huh. So how do you connect the bike to the dog?
Mm-hmm. How?
Yeah.
Just a regular ski during line, and I hook it around right under where the handlebars go across.
And you think that's safer than being on skis?
For me, it sure is, yeah.
Wow. Wow, I'd never heard of that. I would like to see that. I'd like to see a picture of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've got some pictures. There's a mountain biking forum and an Alaska sub category in it. You can find some pictures there.
Oh, great. Well, maybe when we're done talking, you can give that link to our producer, and we'll put it up on our website.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Great idea. Well, thanks a lot, Heidi. I've never heard of that. Have you heard of that? No, Deborah's shaking her head.
Oh, yeah. Some of our ski gear friends have taken them out on bikes, too, but I don't know. If you fall on skis, I think it would be less painful.
It would feel better, yeah. Well, I was thinking if the dog just tried to make a quick turn, you'd be over on the bike.
I've had some pretty epic wipeouts bike touring.
Oh, you've done it?
Oh, yeah. I've never done it in the winter on a fat tire bike, but I've done it in the summer on the pavement, and... Yeah, I've had some. I've seen a couple bikes get destroyed that way too. When I had two dogs pulling me, and dog took a hard right turn. I flipped over the handlebars. Dog got scared of the bouncing bike, and then they drug the bouncing bike for about 500 yards.
Oh my goodness!
That was the end of that bike.
Yeah, I imagine. Well, that's. I've learned something new. I never knew that this is a sport before. Maybe a tricycle would be a better idea. So,
yeah.
So, Jamie, you're kind of using sled dogs sort of the way they were originally intended to be used, doing, you know, these longer trips across the wilderness. And for, you know, folks who are used to doing backcountry trips, I would imagine you can cover a lot more territory with a dog team. Like, how long of a trip would you be able to do in, you know, by the day?
We average, my dogs, we can generally average around 30 miles a day is what I usually average on trips when I'm doing in the backcountry. But it's, the nice thing about it is I don't have to carry any of it all on my back. All the gear and stuff is in the sled. Some days it's less mileage depending on trail conditions. There is no trail, and I'm making the trail myself with snowshoes. 4 or 5 miles might be a big day, but if we got good trail and good conditions, I can easily do 30 miles with these dogs.
That's great. That makes the trip more fun because you get to see more territory.
Oh, yeah. We can cover, I can go out 60, 70, 80 miles from my home here and back in a week's time and see lots of country.
Well, we're out of time. I've enjoyed this show very much. And incidentally, Heidi's pictures of herself bike touring are on our Facebook page. Just go to Facebook and type in Outdoor Explorer. And thanks to my guests in the studio, Deborah Baines from the Learning Farm here in Anchorage. Jamie Milliken is a musher and a guide up in the Denali area, works with Earth Song Lodge, where you can do some mushing. Next week on Outdoor Explorer, I'll be out of town, so Annie Fight will be hosting on ice climbing. In preparation for the show, Annie actually took a stab at ice climbing for the first time. Hear about her experience learning the sport and some historic first ascent ice climbs next week, 2 p.m. on KSKA. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Kristen Spack is our producer. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Charles Wolforth. Happy trails.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to alaskapublic.org.